All right, midterm. So with one exception, all of the scores were in such a narrow range that I would not characterize them as statistically significant. Okay. The one exception is a person who simply didn't answer two of the questions. One of them, there's a note in the paper that says, I couldn't come up with a plausible answer for the question. And the other one, I'm actually concerned that the answer may have been missing through oversight. And I will send that person a note. So, but with that exception, and I think that person would have come out okay if they'd answered those two questions, basically I'm very happy with the outcomes. The total, I sort of just assigned 10 points arbitrarily to every question, so the total was out of 70, and the scores ranged from, again, ignoring this one individual, from 55 on the low end to 67 or 68 on the high end. So, I guess that is a significant gap, but in the midterm, it's small. It's real easy to mess one thing up, and that's not something we should count against people. However, there were a number of patterns in the answers, and that prompts me to actually want to try to go through them. So, question one was, how do you execute a denial of service attack in a reference counting system? And the answer basically is, you create it, you hand it to me, and I don't let go. Right? And I'll run you out of starch. Okay, what should the, question two, a couple of people read it in a slightly different way than it was intended. So the question was, what happens to the capability when the object's destroyed? Okay? And the upshot of it is, you can't have dangling pointers in the system, so something's got to happen. Okay, because you certainly, after I take the storage away and I turn it into something else, you certainly don't want an invocation on an old capability to make progress. Okay, and then the question is, well, so what happens when I invoke it? And there are three things that might happen, two of which turn out as a matter of implementation to actually be the same thing. The first is, invoking a stale capability might cause an exception. Okay. The second is, it might cause some kind of an error code. Now we're just arguing about what's the label we're going to attach to the error code, right? These are both error codes. That's a distinction that matters when we ask, how are we going to think about this for purposes of language runtime integration? And that's actually an important pragmatic distinction for the programmer, but it's not a mechanism distinction at the bottom. Now, the other possibility is, well, maybe invoking such a capability never returns. Right? Maybe the invocation just goes off into space, and there's no reply. No notification of any sort. There are two reasons not to do the last one. Part of me likes it, because it has the property that, in effect, I never get any notification about an action you took that makes an object go away. Okay? And that closes a channel of communication. So part of me actually, sort of an extremist hypothetical designer part of me actually likes that outcome, but it's not pragmatically viable. The reason it's not pragmatically viable is there exist these things in the world called mistakes. I, of course, never make them. I'm sure most of you never make them. But there are these programmers who make these mistakes. And there also exist events that happen in the world that have nothing to do with the parties engaged in the communication. So, for example, I'm the system administrator, right? I create your account. In the course of doing that, I allocate some storage, okay? You run a program, right? It collaborates with somebody else. The other guy is now engaged in this communication back and forth with your program, okay? And the system administrator comes along and says, I'm destroying the account. Now, we certainly like it to be the case that when my account goes away, your programs do not fail. Or at least that if they're going to fail, they should fail in some predictable fashion. Okay. And there are two ways to make it fail. One is, after I go away, you invoke a capability to me, now what? And the other is, while I'm running, and you're waiting for me to reply, I get whacked, now what? And the second case is interesting, but it's not on the midterm, so let me come back to that in a minute. Okay, argument for unbounded payload. Apps, well, with one exception, everybody got that, and the exception was basically a nit. And the exception amounts to, I took off two points because this person was inexcusably lazy on a take-home midterm where they had plenty of time. Okay, in any situation where you do not have an unbounded IPC operation, something will need more bytes than you got. What do you do about it? Okay, so essentially everybody got the same score on this, but in fact nobody answered the question I meant to be asking. What I was after in this question was to explain how that mechanism of the trusted buffer object does what it does. The answers I got back amounted to, go use a trusted buffer object cited here. Which, you know, given the question, was a reasonable response, but it didn't actually achieve what I was trying to achieve with the question. So let me come back to that one. I'm going to skip ahead now to 6 and 7. So in 6, most people actually took the trouble to sort of think about, what that question wanted was to actually think about what the failure of personalities to generalize and the experiences paper was trying to say and try to synthesize out of that some conclusions. And most people gave me some evidence that they'd really sort of thought a bit about what was being said in those papers. Experience leads me to conjecture that you will probably all forget that the next time you start a large project. Nobody remembers what Fred Brooks has to say. Why should you remember these guys? One person said that something that was not actually sort of in the scope that I intended it, but it was interesting enough that I want to respond to it. They said, well, you know, IBM is now building these virtual machines, and so clearly they still think this can be done. That's not the case. It is the case that IBM is building virtual machines. In fact, they had been building virtual machines for decades before this project was started, very successfully. There's an enormous difference between building a virtual machine environment that's going to run multiple operating systems, but each on a distinct logical machine, and building a single operating system that tries to integrate the semantics of multiple operating systems. So the critical distinction, well, there are several distinctions, but the critical distinction for purposes of evaluating the lessons of the paper is, in a virtual machine, there's no attempt to integrate semantics. None. In fact, the whole point is not to do that. Where Workplace Shell bogged down was in trying to integrate fundamentally incompatible semantic distinctions. And the incompatibilities range from things as mundane as disagreements in the operating system about how end of line is encoded in a file, right, to differences in what it means to be a memory object, right, to differences in the permission architectures of the respective systems. Now, taken individually, you look at each of these things and you say, boy, this is a pain in the ass. I can come up with some clues that'll get this merger like 98% right, and I'll probably get away with it. The answer is, no, you won't, but you'll get away with it good enough that your marketing department can make the issue cloudy so that nobody can really complain successfully, and if your job is to sell systems, that's good enough. The problem is, you know, these little deviations, they don't stand in isolation, and some of them are not so little. Okay, yes, if I know I'm looking at a text file, I can build a translator that deals with the new line conversion issue that just gets shoved in there transparently according to who's the client. And you think, that'll work. Okay? But what that ignores is your whole notion of a file offset changed. And that notion is actually a very foundational notion in manipulation of files. That's not a simple thing to change. And you've also just said, I'm going to introduce the idea of a modal distinction between text files and non-text files. And there were certainly operating systems, there remain operating systems today, that have that distinction, but there are also operating systems that don't. And those operating systems, the idiom is you open the file and you blast bytes and you declare victory and you don't even tell me that it's a text file. So these seemingly small issues propagate into the way that people build programs in ways that are really, really hard to back out of. Unicode is turning out to provide a really interesting test of this, right? So from the standpoint of people who wanted text files to actually be text, Unicode's a disaster. How many new line conventions are there? I don't know. How many countries you got? Okay. Furthermore, it used to be the case that at least if I wanted a, you know, 5-character string, I knew 5 bytes would do it. And under Unicode, what I know is 20 bytes will do it. Right. Of those 20 bytes, if I look at the actual utilization of the encoding space, right, there are countries where I'm going to need to use those long encodings, but for an awful lot of the world, I don't. And so, you know, we start having variable length fields in the middle of things like database records, and that's really not pretty. Okay. And then the last one was the trusted window system. If you didn't get this, you didn't read the paper, because it's right there in the paper. Okay. The paper says right out in front, somewhere around the 8th or 9th page, that yep, the window system actually allocates a data structure for every client. And it's right there in black and white that that data structure allocation is a potential denial of resource issue. Okay. So basically the problem is if I get enough clients or if I request enough sessions, I can exhaust the available virtual memory to the window system. And it's not that the data structures per se are the threat. In principle, we could redesign the window system in such a way that those data structures would get allocated out of client-provided storage, and that storage would get mapped into the window system. There are two problems with doing that. The first is, well, now the client could revoke that storage, and so now any place where the window system is touching this data structure, it has to be prepared for the possibility that it's going to take a page fault. Now, you know, it might be that if we sat down and thought about it, we would come up with programming idioms that would make that survivable, but we don't have it today. Okay. So that's a nuisance. And there are ways that we could imagine dealing with that, but we haven't. The second, the more important one is, even if I solved the need to make this storage come from somebody else, it is still the case that somehow the window system needs to maintain a collection data structure which says, here are all of my sessions. Okay. All of the collection data structures of that sort that we know how to do involve pointers. Those pointers occupy storage. That storage can't come from the client, because if the client yanks bits of the data structure out from the middle, we can't reconstruct the rest of the data structure. And here again, maybe we could come up with a data structure design that would solve that, but we don't know of one right now. I should add, we haven't really tried. In my opinion, the right solution to this is to say, you know what? If you blow off the Windows server, maybe you don't get all your storage back. Okay. So it might be the case, and I haven't thought through how to actually do this, and I'm not even convinced it's doable, but it might be the case, the right model is that I come to the Windows server and I say, look, I am giving you the page. Okay. And we'll come up with some mechanism that if I die, you will get an orderly request to release the page. Problem, of course, the Windows system could fail to do that, so now the Windows system is executing denial of service against whoever is reclaiming the storage. So this is not easy. So I want to come back to the IPC question, and the question was vaguely worded, and that was because I was looking for a broad answer. I've not yet learned how to phrase questions where I'm looking for a big picture answer, where somehow the question doesn't come out vaguely worded. So the question was, what other considerations are important in the design of an IPC mechanism? And, you know, people replayed a bunch of the things that we've talked about in the classroom, all of which is fine, none of which was what I was actually looking for. Suppose I change the specification of an IPC, or any capability invocation, simply because it's easier to say. I tend to say, because it's easier to say, and because most of the invocations turn out to be IPCs, and because the community at large talks a lot about IPC, I tend to say IPC very often. What I mean is invocation. Suppose I were to change the IPC specification to say, well, I'm not going to reload some segment register. And if you want to keep it, then before you do the system call, you got to save it. And after you come back from the system call, you got to reload it. I just lowered the cost of the IPC, right? There's a step I don't do. More precisely, if I were going to really do this on the Pentium, I'd have to say, I'm going to restore CS, DS, SS, probably ES because of string move instructions. I am not going to restore FS or GS for you. In fact, I could go ahead and say, I'm only going to restore CS and the rest is up to you. Or CS and SS, depending on which kernel exit mechanism I use in the hardware. And the others, I'm going to put nulls in. I have to nullify them because I don't want whatever may still be in them to kind of leak across the boundary, but it turns out that loading null into a segment register is a special case in the Pentium because it doesn't involve a memory reference. Okay, so is that an improvement in the IPC design? Yeah.
I guess it depends on whether or not the nullified, like, you need the registers when you get returned from the call.
Depends on whether you need the values.
Right.
So if my application needs the values, what I've done, I haven't removed the requirement to save and restore the values. All I've done is shove it around. And if all I've accomplished is to shove it around, if that's all I've accomplished, then, you know, the story that I improved the IPC performance by doing this is just bullshit. I didn't remove any work. Right? I just moved it into your wallet. Which, by the way, it was coming from anyway, because I was doing the IPC for you. In fact, I've added work. Because if those registers were needed, then there was no option about reloading them. They had to be reloaded. The only question was who was going to do it. Okay? And if I don't do it down in the kernel, right now, two new costs come into the picture because the reload is not avoidable. The new costs are you've got to save them on the way in, and I've got to load those stupid null entries. And that's all wasted work if they're needed. All right, so what's the story under which this might be the right thing to do?
They're frequently not needed.
Right. So, on the Pentium, I have to have the code segment. I'm not going to execute anything without a valid code segment. Okay. I don't, strictly speaking, have to have the stack segment because conceivably I could write programs that don't use the stack, and there actually are a few such runtimes out there. But after we're done with both of those programs in the universe, I need the stack segment. Okay.
You need the data segment.
Most of us write programs that involve data. That has been my experience. I actually do know of one program that runs entirely in registers and never touches memory. And because I'm on the Pentium, I could evade this if I used the segment override prefix, but it's helpful if I always have ES. ES is the so-called extra segment, and when I'm doing a string move, the source comes from DS and the target goes to ES, and it's just, it's convenient if I don't have to mess with, oh shoot, was ES loaded, or introduce a prefix override. Then there are these other two registers. FS and GS. And depending on whether we're running Windows or Linux, one or the other of these, the two of them use different answers, is actually used to point to thread local storage. The other is not used in practice. Now, so what are these new costs, right? So the new costs are the save, the nullify, the nullify is in the kernel, okay, and the save is in the app.
The save wouldn't be a new cost, though. It would just be a transfer cost.
No, it turns out... you're saying if the kernel is not going to reload them anyway, there's no point to save.
New costs for moving where from what model to what model? From the kernel saving and loading...
So the old model... Okay, is... that everything is saved and restored in the kernel. Okay. And by the way, the whole discussion that we're having is valid if we're talking about IPC. It is not valid if we're talking about interrupts. And the distinction is the application never gets a chance to plan for the interrupt coming. So it never has a chance to save anything. Right? The interrupt's path has to fully save and restore the context no matter what. Okay.
Right, the new model is right app saves and restores
some of this stuff. And then we're gonna negotiate about how much.
So the save isn't a new cost, it's a new costs to the programmer of the app to actually have to write the functionality, but you still have the ops happening.
Yeah, so let's take the programmer cost out of this, because in fact, if we're going to do this, this save is going to happen in one of two places. It's either going to happen in code that's automatically generated by an IDL sub-generator, or it's going to happen in some piece of kernel supply trampoline code. Either way, it's a one-time human burden. Okay? The day-to-day programmer is not going to need to pay attention to this. Yeah, one guy will write a piece of assembly code someday. That, who cares? Right? Is there any way I could avoid the save of my code selector? Let me not do code selector, because the kernel, because of the software, because of the hardware return protocol, the kernel actually is effectively obligated to restore SS and CS. There's no actual way out of the kernel that really works without restoring both of these. Technically, the AMD syscall sysret does not restore SS or ESP, and it turns out nobody uses the instruction because it turns out working around that is a big pain in the butt. So let's just wave our hands and say, we're not going to mess with those two. Those are going to get saved and restored in the usual way. Now, what about these others? Is there some story for why I might not need the saving? Yes, I have to assume it does. In particular, there may be a preemption point down in there that where I might block on something. So in the general case, I have to behave as though this system call may cause a context switch.
Okay, well then don't save those registers then?
No. These saves are either saved on entry to the kernel or they're never going to be saved. This is the time we're doing the save, if we're going to do it. Why would I not need to do it?
Right.
It's a constant. It's a known constant value. I don't need to save it. And why would these be a known constant value? Because segmentation was a really, really dumb idea, okay? And all the operating systems out there are moving as fast as they can go to a flat 4 gigabyte addressing model. And the way they do that is they set up a 4 gigabyte segment entry in the descriptor table. They say, in this API, the magic selector values are 10 and 18 hex, okay? And CS ought to hold 10, and everything else ought to hold 18, and if you screw with those, it's on you. Well, there's no reason to save them because there's no choice about what I'm going to reload. Okay, so the steps were, one, move the work out of the kernel, and then two, drop the work. Okay. Now the kernel has to nullify some of these things on the way out because it can't leave them dangling. Now, caveat, if we were in a position to know that with absolute certainty these registers were going to get reloaded in user land and there was nothing the user could do to bypass that, then in fact we don't have to nullify them. This is possible in this particular architecture. It is very dicey and should be done with extreme fear and trembling. Okay. Now, however, there was an assumption here, which was they were constant values. And we may have programs that violate that assumption. The theory here is those programs are likely to be alien programs, programs that don't actually know they're running on this system, right? They're foreign binaries and we're doing compatibility, okay? And for those programs, they may carry an extra burden of a saving restore. But if those programs are rare, this was the right trade. Okay, why did I go through this whole particularly convoluted example, by the way. And by the way, I want to say, the scenario I'm describing here, okay, is the emerging explanation that corrects something I published almost 3 years ago now, stating that this was a security bug in L4. In fact, it is not a security bug in L4. It only took 2 years of argument to determine that, yes, no, it really wasn't a security bug in L4. Okay? 10 cycles were saved, max. This, now that the argument's known, maybe this is a good trade-off. But I mean, if you'd asked me going in, if I know it's going to be 2 years before I'm convinced this is secure, is 10 cycles worth it? The answer is no, for me. By the way, it was not a big security bug. Okay, let me give another example. Suppose I don't send you, when I call you, suppose I do not send you anything like a resume capability. So there are two ways I could do a call protocol. I could say every time I call, I will send you the capability on which you are going to reply. Right? This is more or less a sessionless kind of a protocol. The others say, look, when I get introduced to you, we will establish a session. Once the session is established, you will, as part of the session establishment, get the capability on which you're going to reply. Later, all I got to do is tell you what the session was, and you'll know which one to use. And what that buys me in the IPC path is I no longer have to transfer the capability. Is that a good trade? You're looking puzzled there.
I'm not sure I understand the...
Okay, so in the session list protocol, this is a measured result. To first order, in a session list design, 50% of the messages are going to transfer exactly one capability. Because it turns out if we take the call returns and dynamically look at all of the IPCs, all the things that are not calls and returns, they're completely insignificant. Okay? So, and if the rest of calls and returns, our hope is that the calls and the returns are about equal. Well, the calls are going to send a capability, right? So that's 50% of our messages, give or take. Maybe it's 49.998. Okay? In the session pool protocol, 1L, again, the calls, instead of transferring a capability, they transfer a session ID, which the server is going to look up a previously stored capability.
When it's stored.
So basically, when a client first comes to a server, they do a negotiation in which the client says, until further notice, here is the capability. When you want to reply to me, you should reply on this capability. And the server comes back and says, here's the session ID to tell me to use. And there's a spoofing issue in here. So let me allege, let me wave my hands, that the session ID is going to be a protected payload. So we can't spoof it. Which is better? Is the session ID design actually improving?
So doesn't it depend on usage patterns a lot? The client is talking to a particular server a lot, that it might make a lot of sense to set up the session. But if they're just doing one call and one call only, then the session lists, you avoid the extra round by setting up the session.
All right, so there's a recurring versus a one-shot issue. I agree. There is nothing in the IPC that is designed to support the session pool protocol. Right. There's nothing that prevents me from sending a capability. It's more that the design is actually not laid out to explicitly favor that. Yeah.
Is sending a session ID as protected payload somehow faster or smaller or easier?
Well, that's the belief. That's the belief. Okay. And let me come back then. You had a question as well.
How could you know when you're setting it up if it's a recurring or a one-shot deal?
I'm the client. I know what I'm planning to do with you. If I'm going to send you one request, why should I bother with the session? No. Don't agree to that so fast. Okay? Because you're the server. You don't know what I'm going to do with you.
Right?
So you got to be prepared to do both protocols as a code multiplication. Scott?
Sessionless will not leave the server open to denial of resource attack by allowing me to generate a ton of sessions.
Good. Server's got to pay for storage to support session full. That's an issue. What about just pure performance issues? Forget all this other stuff. These are good issues, but just for a minute, set them aside. Let's talk pure performance. There's an assumption here. The assumption is that sending a session ID is cheaper than sending a reply capability. Okay? Now, the argument goes, this session ID, it's going to come out of the capability that's being invoked. So we already, if we're even doing the invocation, we already have these bits in our paws. Copying them is now relatively low cost. Whereas, in order to send this reply capability, I've got to find it on the sender side to know where to copy it from. And it's going to move from a slot on the sender side, it's going to get copied to a slot on the destination side. I got to find that slot. And those searches take time. And depending on the capability design, the copy may take time. If I have a linked list to update in here, that's a marginal 60 cycles at least, and that's assuming a 20 cycle decache miss time, which does not exist anymore. So the copy can be expensive.
When you create automatically a resume capability,
I didn't say we were going to create it automatically.
I was looking at the session list story.
I'm not saying we're going to create it automatically. If I create it automatically, I can eliminate the lookup on the sender side.
Right. Just backing up a step, my point is in the session list protocol, when I make a call, I'm passing a resume capability which I've created just for this call, right?
Not necessarily. That's the way it worked in Eros. We probably will not do that in Kairos.
Okay. What I'm asking is, if I'm a client and I'm making a call on a session pool session, then I make my invocation, and I also have to do a wait on the corresponding capability, which is
yes.
The resume capability. So that would require a mechanism for specifying what my resume capability is when I make my call, right?
No, if I'm doing a resume capability, then you don't have an explicit receive endpoint for waiting for that result. It's just a different design. And maybe I should go through that, but I'm not going to try to do it in the next 4 minutes. So let me take that back up next week.
So do you not have to look up your... Does the client not have to look up its end of the capability to do a wait on it in the session pool design?
In the session pool design, yes. The client has to find that pure capability.
Okay.
In the resume capability design, it doesn't, because the resume versus start is actually tied to the open versus closed wait. The client is waiting for the reply, and the resume capability is actually not on a queue. There's actually nothing to look up. It's resolved as a process state problem, so it's actually just a different design. In the endpoint design, I've got two capabilities, the one I'm sending on and then the one I'm going to receive on, and I have to locate both of those, yes.
Okay, so in... the session list design, both the client and the server have to do a lookup on their capability tables, right? Because
yes.
But in the session full design, it seems like they both have to do a lookup anyway. They're just each looking up a different thing. I mean, the client has to look up the thing that it's going to wait on, and the server, given the ID, still has to use that ID to look up the capability it needs to return on its
right.
table.
And this is actually part of why, in the all four sec design discussions, there has been some back and forth about how that second capability should be implemented. And whether that receive endpoint should be unified with the process so that there's no need to do an additional lookup. And I don't know what this week's resolution to that back and forth is. I haven't looked at their spec, but I know there was some back and forth about that and some debate. There is an issue in what you say. Okay. And you can imagine doing a resume capability design without some of the other complications of resume capabilities that made them difficult, where you would synthesize this thing, but it would not disappear at the end of the call.
It doesn't seem completely self-evident to me that sending the session ID is really going to be that much faster or faster at all.
It's not. Okay? So here's the deal. You're absolutely right about the lookup. Right, if you do a two-endpoint design. Indeed, both parties are going to have to do a lookup. Now, the two questions we've got to ask are, how expensive is the lookup, and how expensive is the copy? Whether the expense of the lookup is actually a neutral factor, right? It depends on how we architect capability storage in the microkernel. We do it with an address space, we're going to have to do some kind of an address space traversal. If we do it with a capability register design, Then in the common case, we'll do, you know, an index and go through a little vector. And in the uncommon case, we'll fall back to the memory search, but that won't be the case that drives performance. Okay. But either way, this is about how do we architect the design of capability storage. It's not about how do we architect the message protocol. So now the question we've got to ask is, what about the cost of the copy? Okay, and in Eros, the cost of the copy was 4 words moved and 2 linked list entries updated, and that was actually surprisingly expensive because of the cache misses. In Kaedos, the answer is 4 words moved, period. We were able to get rid of the linked lists. Okay. In L4SEC, it turns out they don't have currently a capability copy operation. The closest thing they have is a map operation. That map operation has to update bookkeeping information so that the mapping can be revoked. And they're talking about various other mechanisms that might allow them to specialize that in some curious way. And if I understand the mechanism correctly, and I'm not entirely convinced I do, they've actually reinvented the mock reply port because they seem to have the notion of a capability that can be transferred but cannot be met. And the problem with that notion is now, before I can do an operation involving a capability, I've got to know which kind of capability I'm manipulating because I might lose it. There's a failure of uniformity in behavior out of that design, and that failure of uniformity was in practice a real complication in mock. So in mock reply ports, I could hand them off, but I couldn't copy them. And the fact that these had different behavior from all other capabilities was a complication application design. Okay. But I would say, and this is an opinion, that, look, I certainly don't want to stop people from building session full protocols. There are good reasons to do that. But there doesn't appear to be a performance-motivated reason for doing that. The question is, do I want to provide good support for a sessionless protocol? And the answer is, well, what happens if I don't? If my orientation is session-full, what I'm assuming is that all of my servers are going to carry the code to manage the sessions. Okay, so I've pulled these two examples out. What's the thing in common between these two examples? And this is by way of trying now to answer what was I after with this question in the midterm. The point is, you can't make a design about an IPC change in isolation. And measuring the hot cache null IPC numbers is garbage. That can tell you, it's not entirely garbage, it can tell you if you've made certain kinds of mistakes. Certainly it can tell you, did you do something silly in your implementation? It can tell you if you've done something grossly wrong in the architecture. Okay? But that's not the whole story. Because I've never observed an application to do a null IPC in a real system. Excuse me, ignoring these micro-retrofs. So actually I've observed one. Okay. Now, so if I'm going to look at a change in an IPC, the question is not, what's the performance implications for the null IPC micro-benchmark that nobody gives a damn about, aside from certain conference committees? The question is, what's the systemic impact on the behavior of applications? And by the way, in the session pool story, not only did we have to do a lookup down in the IPC to find the two slots, but the application had to do a lookup to map from the session ID to the slot address. So the story was we were trying to save a couple of cache misses, more than a couple actually, in fact, with map. We were trying to save some cache misses in the capability transfer, and what we did was we added code to the service and we moved those cache misses up into the server. Now, in some cases, will you get a direct map and you'll have a really easy lookup? Sure. Those aren't the servers that have this problem. So the other factors you want to look at when you're looking at the design of an IPC, as you contemplate a change in the architecture, what is the impact on applications? What complexity does it add or remove? What performance does it add or remove? Not to the IPC path, but to the entire picture. Right? And in particular, what's the effect in the cold cache case. Because again, aside from contrived benchmarks, there are very few interactions in the world that happen in hot cache. There are a couple, and they are important, and you have to do well in that case, but you have to do well in the cold cache case as well. Now, I'm not saying L4 does bad. In fact, L4 does very well. Okay. I'm saying it's really important to go through the systemic impacts of the change and anticipate what are the other consequences. You're looking at a code path, and there are obviously going to be consequences in that code path. What are the other consequences in the architecture? Okay. So the answer I was actually after here amounts to you need to think systemically when you're building systems. Okay. End of midterm rant. And
that doesn't just go for IPC, right?
No, I hope not.